Cats tuned to yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and coming up in this hour, horror. Later on, it's Nelson Olmsted, the very talented storyteller, in his own program called Sleep No More. But right now, it's Murder at Midnight, featuring the tale The House That Time Forgot. The syndicated broadcast first heard on October 19th, 1946.
Murder at Midnight.
Good evening.
What? Who are you?
I beg your pardon?
I said, who are you? What are you doing here?
My name is Gabriel. I am butler to the Holloway.
Gabriel? But you can't be. Well, you're dead.
Midnight, the witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in The House That Time Forgot. And now, Murder at Midnight, tales of mystery and terror by radio's masters of the macabre. Our story by Sigmund Miller is The House That Time Forgot. Early evening on a desolate part of the Virginia coast, along a road near the beach comes a car with two people in it.
I guess we've done enough looking for today, Eva.
Oh, it's really beautiful country around here, dear. Wild and lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Darling, if we can't find a house, perhaps we should buy some land and build.
Well, we'd better start back to town. It's getting dark, and I think we're in for a storm.
Oh, look, Fred.
Hmm?
Look at that house we're coming to.
Right.
Oh, now, isn't it a beauty?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nobody that owns that one would want to sell it.
Drive slowly, dear. I'd like to take a good look at it.
All right.
There's a for sale sign.
Yeah?
This house for sale, see Mr. Cecil Smith, Westfield, Virginia.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, let's drive in, dear, into the grounds.
We can come back tomorrow, Eva. It's really starting to blow up.
But it'll only take a minute. I've just got to have a close look.
All right, but we're going to get caught in the rain. I'll back in to save time. Well, watch the fenders on that side.
All right, dear, I'll watch. Come ahead.
Am I clear?
Okay, you're all right. Fine. Ah, there's a light in one of the gable windows.
I guess somebody's home.
Beautiful, Fred. Simply magnificent.
Yeah, the grounds look a little neglected, though.
Grounds? Who cares about that? Go ahead and knock.
Okay. I wish they'd hurry. We're going to get caught in a storm.
Oh, don't worry about it. They don't seem to answer, do they? Try knocking again.
Hmm. That's odd. Must be somebody home. We saw a light in the window.
Maybe they can't hear us. Let's try calling them.
Oh. Hello there. Hello.
That's very strange.
Yeah.
What?
I hear something. Listen.
It's a clock striking.
Now, let's try the door. Oh, it's not locked. What do you think?
Let's go in. It's a big place, but lovely.
Wait a minute, dear. Anybody home?
Well, if there is, they can't hear us or don't want to.
Come on, dear. We'll come back tomorrow.
Place needs fixing up, but it's worth fixing. Shall we take it?
Well, I don't know, Eva. We'll talk to the agent in Westfield, and then, well, we'll see.
Interested in buying the Holloway house?
Yes, Mr. Smith.
It's just the kind of house we've been looking for.
It's a fine place, all right. Even got a private inlet to moor a large-sized boat. It's got everything except...
Except what, sir?
Well, it's only fair that I tell you all it's Defects?
What defects, Mr. Smith?
Well, you see, Mrs. Jordan, it's kind of hard to put your finger on it. There's something very queer about the house.
Oh. You mean it's haunted?
Well, I don't know exactly, Mr. Jordan. No one has seen a ghost there yet.
Well, we don't mind ghosts, do we, Fred?
No, we don't believe in them.
Well, I didn't say it was haunted, but, well, people say that the house is alive, that it has a life and a will of its own.
A life? Well, I don't know what you mean.
Well, I've had 4 caretakers in the Holloway house since I took possession of it, and none of them stayed more than a few days.
Well, why did they quit?
I don't know. They didn't see any ghosts or apparitions, but they all felt the same way, that the house was alive. Every one of them.
Oh, well, there must have been something that scared them away.
Well, I'd better tell you the whole story.
Yes, we'd like to hear it.
Please do.
Now, the house originally belonged to Richard Holloway.
Mm-hmm.
7 years ago, in 1939, Richard and his wife, Diana, went on a short cruise in their yacht, the Viking Second.
Oh, that's an interesting name, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
They never came back.
Oh?
They had 2 friends visiting them who refused to go with them. The strangest part about it is that these friends warned them that they'd never return alive from the cruise. The Holloways laughed at them.
Oh, well, how did they know, these friends, that the Holloways wouldn't come back?
I don't know. Nobody knows.
Well, did you talk to these friends?
No, I never saw them. I only know about it through John Gabriel. He was the Holloways' butler.
Oh.
Been dead for 2 years now. As a matter of fact, even Gabriel didn't know these friends. He'd never seen them before. It's a mystery that I've thought about for years. I'm afraid it's going to be a mystery forever.
Hmm. Very interesting, but we'd still like to buy the house.
Mr. Smith, there was a light shining in one of the windows when we were there yesterday. We also heard a clock chiming.
That's funny. No one's been inside that house in over a year.
Oh? Eva, perhaps we ought to think this over.
Oh, nonsense, darling. You're not going to let some old wives' tale bother you, are you?
No. But how could a clock still be going if no one's been in that house for a year?
Well, there's a life buoy not far from the house. You might have mistaken it for the clock.
Now, you see, everything has a logical explanation.
Yeah, what about the light in the window?
Well, it was probably a reflection from the sun or something. We'd like to take the house, Mr. Smith.
Well, if you want it, I'd be glad to sell it to you. I just thought it fair to tell you all about it, so if anything happens, you can't blame me.
Well, here we are, darling. Our house.
I hope we'll like it.
Oh, of course we will. Let's go in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the key, dear?
Yes, but we don't need it. The door was open, remember?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Hey.
It's locked again.
Oh, Mr. Smith must have locked it. In you go, dear.
Well, look.
Hmm?
Darling, everything clean. Dusted. Why, it's spotless. Oh, now, Mr. Smith really is a dear.
Hey, it looks lived in, doesn't it?
I told you we'd like it.
I suppose. You also put flowers around.
It does smell of flowers. Roses. But let's look around. Bright-looking kitchen, isn't it, Fred?
Yeah.
And this wonderful big refrigerator.
And it's full of food.
No.
Fresh food, yeah.
Oh, that Mr. Smith, why, he thought of everything. Oh, the bedroom is even bigger than I thought.
Look at the beds.
What?
Someone has slept in them.
That man Mr. Smith sent to clean the house must have slept in it.
Yes, and he apparently slept in both beds.
This library. Darling, look at that paneling.
Yeah, it's a very lovely room. Everything is charming. But...
But what?
Look at the fireplace.
Well, what's wrong with the fireplace? There's just some half-burnt logs in it.
Yes, just some half-burnt logs. Still smoldering.
Well, it was the cleaning man.
I don't think there was a cleaning man.
Now, don't be absurd, Fred.
Huh. The clock we heard the first time we were here. Eva, I just can't shake off the feeling that someone is still living here.
You're being ridiculous.
Well, maybe I am, but I feel like an intruder.
Oh, darling, it's that story Mr. Smith told us about the Holloways and their mysterious friends. It's got you all keyed up.
Yeah, well, I'm going to call Mr. Smith and find out about that cleaning man you think he sent here. Yeah, operator. Oh, operator, give me Westfield 403.
You're really being a fusspot, Fred.
Yeah, we'll see. Hello, Mr. Smith?
Yes?
This is Fred Jordan.
Oh, hello, Mr. Jordan. How's everything up at Holloway?
Oh, everything seems fine. Thanks for having the house cleaned up.
Cleaned up? I don't understand you.
Didn't you send a cleaning man to straighten up the house?
No, Mr. Jordan. The house was sold as is. I never sent anyone over.
Might interest you to know we found the house in a spotless condition. Cleaned and ready for occupancy.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I'll be in touch with you later.
Such a lovely night, darling. I'm glad we came out.
Yeah, we'd better go back to the house.
Oh, now, please don't be upset. There must be some logical explanation.
Mm.
Maybe somebody took advantage of a boarded-up house and was living in it rent-free.
I'd like to correct you, dear. Someone is still living in it besides ourselves.
Sometimes, Fred, you get very ridiculous.
Maybe. Let's go back inside. Look.
What?
There's a fire burning in the fireplace.
Well, now, what's wrong with that?
I haven't touched this fireplace since we got here.
You didn't?
Look. Table is set for tea. Did you do this?
No, I didn't.
Ooh, the teapot is hot.
Somebody must be here, hiding.
If they are, I'll find them. Come on.
I don't understand it. I just...
Cellar to attic and there's no one here.
But it's incredible.
Someone is living here and we can't see them.
It doesn't make sense.
There's somebody here right now. Right in this room. It sounds crazy, but I know it.
Fred.
What?
The clock.
What about it?
It just struck midnight, and it's only 10 o'clock.
A house that is deserted, except for invisible tenants, and a clock that is running backwards. Has it just struck 12 for...
Murder at midnight.
And now, back to Murder at Midnight and The House That Time Forgot.
Fred?
Hmm?
Fred, wake up.
Huh?
Get up.
Huh? What is it, dear? What's the matter?
Look out there, out the window.
Why?
Get up and take a look.
At what? That boat out there in the inlet? It must have put in while we were sleepy.
Can't you read the name, dear?
Huh?
It's the Viking Second.
The Viking Second?
Yes.
Wasn't that the Holloway's yacht? The one that never came back?
That's what Mr. Smith said.
Either Mr. Smith is a fantastic liar or something very fantastic is happening to us.
Perhaps the Holloway's have finally come back.
After 7 years?
It doesn't make sense, none of it.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly.
Darling, we ought to take a close look at the boat.
You don't sound very enthusiastic about it, but... Yes, I suppose we ought to. Whoever's on it might be able to tell us something.
Well, the gangplank is down. Mm. Somebody must have come off the boat.
Well, they couldn't have, dear. At least they didn't come up to the house.
Well, let's go up and see. Hmm?
All right.
Well, there's no one on deck.
Anyone here? No answer. Maybe they're down below.
They must be.
I'd rather not go down there.
Oh, we've got to find out. Let's both go down together.
All right. You keep right behind me.
Oh, don't worry, dear. I will.
Here's the stateroom.
Oh, there's nobody here either.
Anybody here?
No one.
At least...
Yeah, but the beds are still warm. Somebody just left the stateroom a little while ago.
It seems so.
Let's get out of here, Eva. I've got a peculiar feeling down my spine.
It is chilly. We'd better go back to the house.
Lights are on in the living room. Did you put them on?
Just one of the lamps, a floor lamp.
Well, all the ceiling lights are lit.
I can see that, dear. Let's go in.
Here. Well, the door's locked. We didn't even close it when we went out.
No. I remember. We left it open.
Good evening.
Who are you?
I beg your pardon.
I said, who are you?
I'm John Gabriel, butler to the Holloways.
Gabriel?
What? That's right, ma'am. Whom do you wish to see?
Well, we don't want to see anyone. We live here.
I'm afraid you're mistaken, sir. The Holloways live here, have been living here for years.
But this is our house. We bought it.
And the Holloways are dead.
Dead?
Yes.
I'm afraid someone has misinformed you.
Oh, this is like a nightmare. Look here, Gabriel, or whoever you really are. We bought this house from Cecil Smith, a real estate agent in Westfield. He's not the kind of a man who plays practical jokes.
No, he's not. He's a very sober man indeed.
He told us you were dead, too.
As you can see, madam, I'm very much alive.
Oh, this is crazy. We'd better talk to the people who call themselves the Holloways.
Perhaps you should. They'll be in any minute. Please come in, won't you? Will you excuse me if I close the windows? We're going to have a storm.
Perfectly all right.
Would you care for some tea?
Look here, Gabriel. We've been waiting an hour for Mr. Holloway and his wife. They haven't shown up, and I don't think they will. Now, just what is your game?
Would you care for some tea, Mrs. Jordan?
No, thank you.
Did you hear what I said?
Yes, sir, I did. As soon as Mr. and Mrs. Holloway arrive, I'm sure you'll be convinced of your error. They should be here any minute since they plan to leave tonight on a cruise.
Oh, this is mad. Fantastic.
They've come.
Just missed the storm, Gabriel. Oh, hello. I don't believe I know you.
This is Mr. and Mrs. Jordan. Mr. and Mrs. Holloway.
Oh, I'm glad to meet you, Mrs. Jordan. Mr. Jordan.
Well, thank you. Are you Richard Holloway?
Yes.
I can't believe it.
It's all terribly confusing, Mr. Holloway. These people claim that this is their house.
What?
That they bought it from Cecil Smith. They also claim that you, Mrs. Holloway, and myself are dead.
Somebody's playing some kind of a joke on them.
Well, I'd say it was a very unpleasant joke, Dick. We've been living here for years and years, Mr. and Mrs. Jordan.
Oh, before I forget, Gabriel, get our suitcases aboard the yacht, will you? We'll be leaving in a few minutes.
Yes, sir, right away.
Fred, do you suppose that maybe we're dreaming this?
Well, if we are, we're dreaming it together.
I'm sorry, I don't know how this happened to you. Perhaps you'd better stay here for the night. There's plenty of room.
And we'd be delighted to have you.
Would you mind if I called Mr. Smith?
Oh, please do. The phone's right there on the table.
I know, thanks. Operator, let me have Westfield 403. Never. Hello, Mr. Smith?
That's right.
This is Mr. Jordan.
Who?
Fred Jordan. Remember, you sold me the Holloway house.
The Holloway house?
Yes.
You must be mistaken. I never sold it. That property's not for sale.
What are you talking about?
Who is this?
Listen, Mr. Smith, you know very well who I am. You won't get away with this. I'll have you brought into court and I
never heard of you in my life. You must be crazy. Goodbye.
Hello. Hello. He hung up.
What did he say?
He said he never sold the house and he'd never even heard of me.
You must have been taken in by someone who posed as Mr. Smith.
That's really a shame. You have to be very careful these days.
We'd be glad to have you stay here till you find other quarters.
Well,
as a matter of fact, you can stay for a few days until we get back. We're taking a trip on our boat.
Perhaps you'll be able to get it all straightened out in the morning.
I just don't understand it. The Mr. Smith we had dealings with wasn't a crook. I know he wasn't.
Yeah, that was my feeling, too, but I...
You're not going out to sea in this kind of weather.
Oh, we don't mind a little rain.
My husband's a very good sailor, Mrs. Jordan. He can handle the Viking Second in any kind of weather.
Well, it sounds like a gale coming up.
No, we like them. Exciting.
Well, it's dangerous to set out in this weather. Very dangerous.
Oh, now, don't worry about us. We don't drown easily.
Oh, darling, we'd better get started.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm all set.
Are the suitcases aboard?
Yes, Gabriel took them.
Something's wrong with your grandfather clock. It only struck 8 times.
Yes, it's correct. My watch says 8 o'clock, too.
Well, how can that be? It's after midnight.
You really are mixed up, Mr. Jordan. It's only 8 o'clock.
Well, my watch says 1:30.
Well, so does mine.
I'm afraid ours is right, Mrs. Jordan. It's very old, but very accurate.
Of course, there's a legend about it. The story is that it will sometimes go backwards in time.
Has that ever happened?
No. No, it's only a story. It's never gone anything but forward, like any other clock. But it's a nice story, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, delightful.
Might even be true.
Mrs. Holloway.
Yes?
What is today's date?
Why, I believe it's September 10th.
What year?
1939, of course.
1939?
Yes, of course, Fred. Mrs. Holloway, I'd like to ask you and Mr. Holloway something.
Yes?
Please, don't go out on this trip you're planning.
Why not?
Because if you do, I don't think you'll ever come back.
What a terrible thing to say.
Please, Mrs. Holloway, please.
I don't know what's wrong with you two. You came in here with a strange story about owning my house, and now you tell us we're never going to come back.
She's right, you won't come back.
You'll pardon me for saying so, Mr. Jordan, but I think you're both crazy.
I don't care what you think, but please don't go.
Why, Mrs. Jordan?
I have a hunch about it.
We don't believe in hunches.
Well, it's more than a hunch, Mr. Holloway. I know you're not coming back.
If you'll excuse us, I think we'd better get started. Come along, darling.
I'm ready.
I've put everything on board. Is there anything else, sir?
Yes. Just take care of our guests. See that they're comfortable. Goodbye, Gabriel.
Goodbye, and pleasant voyage.
Make yourself at home, and we'll be back, despite your hunches.
Oh, you must go, please.
Gone.
If you wish, you can occupy the master bedroom. I'll go up and make it ready for you. Was there anything else you wished, Mr. Jordan, ma'am?
No, Gabriel. Just go to bed. We'll sit here for a while.
It's rather late, sir. Nearly midnight.
By your clock, Gabriel, but it seems to have stopped.
So it has. It needs rewinding.
It's going now.
Yes. Seems to be ticking rather fast.
Something's wrong. It never did that before.
Fred.
Something's happening.
The lights. Switch them on, Fred.
As soon as I find the switch.
So what happened?
I don't know. Maybe the storm, lightning.
Where's Gabriel?
Oh, Gabriel. Gabriel.
Never mind, dear. Can't you find the switch?
Here it is. Oh.
Fred.
All that dust. Like the first time we saw the house.
Darling, it's as if no one had been here for years. Where's Gabriel?
There is no Gabriel. We're back in 1946. And that means he's dead.
You mean the clock did go backwards?
Something else. You understand too now, don't you? We were the friends that Mr. Smith told us about. The mysterious friends that urged the Holloways not to go on that trip.
Yes. Fred.
What?
The clock has stopped.
Well, it needs rewinding.
No, don't touch it. We won't wind that clock again, ever.
A house without tenants, except for the dead, and a clock that runs backward in time. If it was your clock, would you wind it? Or are you afraid it would keep you up nights while you waited for it to strike 12 for...
Murder at midnight.
Remember to be with us again when death comes out of the past, out of time gone by, and the clocks strike 12 for...
Murder at midnight.
The Jordans, husband and wife, were played by Vinton Hayworth and Elsie Hitz. With music by Bert Berman, Murder at Midnight was directed by Anton M. Leder.
Murder at Midnight, on Tuned 2 yesterday from the 16th of August, 1946, that a syndicated episode. You are listening to An Hour of Horror on Tuned 2 yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to Nelson Olmsted's famous program, Sleep No More. During radio's yesteryear, Olmsted was a world-class storyteller, appearing on his own program as early as 1939, and transitioned from a local program to the NBC Blue Network show The World's Greatest Stories in the early 1940s, where he performed readings. And at the time of this next episode, he was also an actor on the X-1 sci-fi show. This the last in the Sleep No More series, relatively short-lived on NBC. This final broadcast features two stories, Evening and The Flowering of a Strange Orchid, heard on NBC on April 24th, 1957.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Evening. Ernie Mendenhall was now 42 years old, and still he had found no one with whom to share his home. His home was a white house in the town of Oderhill, and his little garden had fine hollyhocks. For 4 years since the death of his parents, he'd lived there alone. And in those 4 years, he had bought now and then a piece of old furniture or a rug or some small article for his house. Every time that he did this, the neighbors would say, Ernie Mendenhall must be going to get married. But so far, he hadn't married. He earned his living as a part-time secretary for a writer who lived in the edge of the town. And every morning, the neighbor saw Ernie's long form swinging its right arm and holding its left arm stiff as it hurried along, his lips moving in imagined talk. And they said, what can he be talking about to himself that way? He hasn't any business of his own to reckon up. One summer weekend, the writer had a house party, and Alla Vintran was his guest. On Sunday morning, she walked into the library where Ernie was working. He saw her frail beauty in its pink linen enclosure, her delicate profile, her heavy hair. The linen, the profile, and the heavy hair attacked him as an epidemic attacks, and he was as one who catches a cold instantly and pervadingly. And she said, is the old secretary in this room the Governor Winthrop secretary? Here, said Ernie with immense difficulty, and bowed, and perceived that he had bowed not to her, but to the mahogany secretary. He managed to talk to her about that piece of old mahogany, and afterward he wondered whether he had not perhaps said, it has a beautiful profile and heavy hair and it wears pink. And though later he tried in agony to recall her words, he could recover nothing save an accent, a murmur, a perfume. Next he noted that he was saying to her that if she was interested in old furniture, he had some good pieces in his house, if she cared. And she said alertly that she did care, and could she see them that morning? With no more thought of his employer than that of an eagle on a far cliff, Ernie walked out of the house and down the streets of Oderhill, and beside him she went. She said little. He liked her for that. She walked rapidly, and that he liked. She wasn't as tall as he. She observed the flowers. She stopped and spoke to a child. She was perfect. Thanking God for an upbringing which had forced him to keep order in his house, he opened his front door and let her in upon the hooked rugs, the cherry chairs, and the one piece of rosewood. It was before this melodeon of rosewood that Alla Vintran paused at last, then sat, pulled out the stops, and pressed from the reluctant instrument its few remaining tones. And at the sound of music played by her in his home, Ernie's years of waiting cried from his throat these words, could you stay? Could you live here? Could you be my wife? And this he didn't hear himself saying from a distance. No. For he was in the very words themselves. She looked around the room, small, sweet and colored, and that the hollyhock's motion must be on the glass. "Why not?" she said. "You could. You would." He wasn't sure that he'd said this at all. And all that he heard her say was, "Why not?" as she moved to the door. He walked beside her under the maples and told her about his life. Always he had wanted to tell somebody about his life. And when he had tried, his confidant had looked at him. Eyes could be puzzled, amused, disdainful. Alla didn't look at him. She merely walked beside him and listened. "Could you, would you marry me?" Ernie said when he was done. "Why not?" she said again, with immense sadness. Three days later, he had a note from Alla. It read, "And I know exactly how you're feeling because you spoke so. I have asked one or two men to marry me and wished afterwards that I hadn't spoken. But you mustn't mind. Those 42 years in Oda Hill, you're likely to ask anybody, anywhere. I did mean to speak to you about that melodeon. I assume that those things are for sale, and if the melodeon is at all within my reach, I should like very much to buy it." Every day, the neighbors saw Ernie's long form as it hurried along, his lips moving in imagined talk with someone. He was writing to Alla Vintran, composing his letters as he walked the streets. He was telling her of his life, its routine, its emptiness. These letters he dared to write out. When her bread-and-butter letter came to the writer, Ernie copied the address, and it burned on his bureau. One night, when it rained, he took out his letters to her, read them over, selected the mildest, addressed it, carried it in his pocket for days. One day, when he had an attack of influenza, he took the letter from his pocket and mailed it. As soon as the letter was mailed, he fashioned her reply, many replies. She would be kind, she would be cold, she would be cruel. All these replies he wrote in his mind. When days passed and no reply came, he said to himself that she'd gone abroad. And when his letter reached her at some lonely foreign place, how touched and warm she would be that he had remembered. He thought that she would write, "My dear friend, you move me greatly." Once he had taken down that sentence dictated by the writer, "My dear friend, you move me greatly." No answer came, but when he was at home for a week with lumbago, he chose another of his letters to her and mailed that. In all, Ernie sent off 6 letters. But the mails, he knew, were uncertain. So he continued to fashion her replies. At last, he wrote down these replies and he read them at home in the evenings. "My dear friend, you move me greatly." His lips whispered as he read. He remembered the phrases in her letters and in his own. And he would go down the street swinging his right arm and holding his left arm stiff as he hurried along. And the neighbor said, "What can he be talking about to himself that way?" One night, sitting alone by a stove, going over one of her replies, it occurred to Ernie Mendenhall that he was tired of those things he was saying as having come from her. Even, "My dear friend, you move me greatly," had become tiresome by repetition. He began to be bored with her. Feeling the wind blowing in the back of his neck, he asked in his mind what had made her leave the window open at the top. Finding the fire low, he said to her in his mind that she could certainly put in a stick of wood when it was he who filled the wood box. The next morning, when he watered a favorite plant, he saw that water had dripped down on the rosewood melodeon, and he cried reproachfully, "You, who pretend to care for this rosewood melodeon, what have you ever done to protect it?" But at that, she answered up quite tartly, and he was startled and hastened out of the house. He found that his homecomings had acquired a new fascination. He would come hurrying into the house and cry, "What? No fire, no supper? A great way to treat a man who's been slaving all day for you." "Oh, slaving indeed," would come her clear reply. "Writing a few letters for a pittance? Oh, I've a good mind to sell your old rosewood melodeon and make some real money for us." And at that, he would fly into a rage and then grow sullen and would eat no dinner. Actually did eat none. And he imagined Alla Vintran Mendenhall cooking a steak savory with onions and eating it all alone. Occasionally, he would smile at himself awkwardly. But less and less often. Then a child was born to his employer, and Ernie Mendenhall was extremely shaken. Arriving one morning for work, he heard that faint wailing above stairs, and all day when the cry came, he could do nothing but listen. And when he went home at night, there was Alla Vintran Mendenhall with a child. But now his imagination failed. He had no idea what he could say to her. He couldn't even look at her. Suddenly, she wasn't there anymore, but was rapt away from him, absorbed in a wailing cry. Sometimes he could catch an outline of her bending head, but when she turned toward him, her face blindingly disappeared and the game stopped. He sat by the stove and imagined her in the room above stairs. He never went there. It was many, many nights before she was downstairs with him again. He sat making milk toast when she entered. He looked at her in awe and in silence, but then his milk boiled over onto the griddle and he said, "Is it or isn't it a woman's job to keep things from boiling over, say?" And when he blackened the toast, he became fairly caustic. After that, they resumed their old quarrels. And when she was unconscionably exasperating, Ernie Mendenhall would hurry along the street, his lips moving as he rehearsed what he would tell her. And the neighbors would say, "Ernie Mendenhall, don't you suppose he works out puzzles as he walks?" As the holidays came near, he wandered about in the shops of the little town, thinking of a gift for her and one for the child. But when he touched this or that, it seemed not worthy of him. He bought one little gift, a vase to stand in her melodeon. He thought of it as her melodeon. And on Christmas Eve, he filled the vase with roses and watched her bend above it with the child. And he thought, well, maybe they meant something like this about Christmas. Maybe it has something to do with somebody being born, not of the flesh. But this he dismissed as unlikely. He prolonged the evening, became involved in dressing an imaginary tree, very tall, and ended in disagreeing with her about having so much tinsel stuff all over everything. He found the fire out and went to bed annoyed by her obstinacy and her carelessness. But he woke once and smelled the roses. In the holiday week, he came dragging home from his work one dim afternoon, and as he approached his house with its white folded spruces, he felt a sense of utter weariness at the look of it. At once he knew this to be the weariness of the end of the game. He understood that the game had played itself out. He didn't know why exactly, but it was over. All was over, the funeral, all. And he entered upon his house as it had been before ever he had seen her. He moved through the little empty rooms, looking at them so differently. Desolation flowed through him. He could experience, but he couldn't believe that she was gone. In his mailbox, a letter waited. Before he opened it, he knew her touch. Alla Vintran wrote, "Dear sir, is the Rosewood Melodeon still for sale? I was married in the spring, and now that we are furnishing our house..." And he replied, "Dear madam, the Rosewood Melodeon is not for sale. I wish to keep it on account of its associations." He went into the white evening and posted the letter at the box where he'd posted all the others, which she must have received. And he turned back toward the house where she had died. He had fallen in love, experienced domesticity, been bored by it, and was left alone in Christmas week with the child whom none had ever begotten. He recounted these things to himself as he walked, and the neighbors, seeing him, said, "Ernie Mendenhall, he's always talking away about something."
Thus, the story of poor Ernie. Well, Nelson, now that we've met Ernie Mendenhall in Zona Gale's story Evening, what's next on tonight's bill?
A story by one of the most distinguished and imaginative of all English writers, Ben, H.G. Wells. The story is all about a most unusual flower. In fact, the tale is called The Flowering of the Strange Orchid. The buying of orchids always has in it a certain speculative flavor. You have before you the brown, shriveled lump of tissue, and for the rest you must trust your judgment, or the auctioneer, or your good luck, as your taste may incline. The plant may be moribund or dead, Or it may be just a respectable purchase, fair value for your money. Or perhaps, for the thing has happened again and again, there slowly unfolds before the delighted eyes of the happy purchaser, day after day, some new variety, some novel richness, a strange twist of the labellum, or some subtler coloration or unexpected mimicry. Pride, beauty, and profit blossom together on one delicate green spike, and it may be even immortality. For the new miracle of nature may stand in need of a new specific name, and what so convenient is that of its discoverer, John Smithia. There have been worse names. It was perhaps the hope of some such happy discovery that made Widder Wedderburn such a frequent attendant at these sales. That hope, and also maybe the fact that he had nothing else of the slightest interest to do in the world. He was a shy, lonely, rather ineffectual man, provided with just enough income to keep off the spur of necessity and not enough nervous energy to make him seek any exacting employment. He might have collected stamps or coins or translated Horace or bound books or invented a new species of diatoms. But as it happened, he grew orchids and had one ambitious little hothouse. Over his coffee this particular morning, he said, "You know, I have a fancy that something is going to happen to me today." And his housekeeper, who was also his remote cousin, said, "Well, don't say that." "Now, you misunderstand me. But I mean nothing unpleasant. Though, what I do mean, I scarcely know. Today, they're going to sell a batch of plants from the Andamans and the Indies. I shall go up and see what they have. Maybe I shall buy something good, unawares. Yeah, that may be it. Nothing ever does happen to me. I wonder why. Things enough happen to other people. I wonder how it feels to have something happen to you, something really remarkable. No, you know, that orchid collector, Fred Batten, he was only 36, 20 years younger than myself when he died. And he'd been married twice, divorced once. He'd had malarial fever four times, and once he broke his thigh. He killed a Malay once, and once he was wounded by a poisoned dart. And in the end, he was killed by jungle leeches. Must have been very troublesome, but then it must have been very interesting, you know. Oh, except perhaps the leeches. Well, I'm sure it wasn't good for him. I suppose the next thing you'll be saying, you wish you was eaten by leeches. When he returned from London that afternoon, he was in a state of mild excitement. He had made a purchase. It was rare that he could make up his mind quickly enough to buy, but this time he had done so. He was telling his cousin all about his trip and his purchases as he slowly meandered through his dinner. "Oh, I knew something would happen today, and I've bought all these orchid rooks. Some of them are, well, I feel sure, you know, that some of them will be remarkable. I don't know how it is, but I feel just as sure as if someone had told me that some of these will turn out remarkable. Now that one, that shriveled little root, wasn't even identified. It may be a Palaeonophus, or it may not. It may be a new species, or even a new genus. And do you know, it was the last that poor Fred Batten ever collected." His housekeeper sniffed. "Huh. Well, I don't like the looks of it. It has such an ugly shape." Wedderburn smiled and surveyed the root with his head on one side. "Well, it's certainly not a pretty lump of stuff. But you can never judge these things from their dry appearance. It may turn out to be a very beautiful orchid indeed. Oh, how busy I shall be tomorrow. You know, they found poor Batten lying dead or dying in a mangrove swamp. No, I forget which. With one of these very orchids crushed up under his body. He'd been unwell for some days with some kind of native fever, and I suppose he fainted. These mangrove swamps are very unwholesome. Every drop of blood, they say, was taken out of him by the jungle leeches. It may be that very plant that cost him his life to obtain. The natives of his party were sufficiently civilized to take care of all his collection until his colleague, who was an ornithologist, came back from the interior. Though they couldn't tell the species of the orchid and had let it wither. And it makes these things more interesting." "Yeah? Well, it makes them more disgusting to me. I should be afraid of some of the malaria clinging to them. And just think, there's been a dead body lying across that ugly thing. Oh, well, I never thought of that before. There, I declare, I can't eat another mouthful of dinner." The next few days, he was indeed singularly busy in his steamy little hothouse, fussing about with charcoal, lumps of teak, moss, and all the other mysteries of the orchid cultivator. He considered he was having a wonderfully eventful time. In the evening, he would talk about these new orchids to his friends, and over again, he reverted to his expectation of something strange. Several of the Vandas and the Denobrium died under his care, but presently the strange orchid began to show signs of life. He was delighted and took his housekeeper right away from her jam-making to see it at once. And he said, this is a bud. And presently, there will be a lot of leaves there. And those little things coming out here are aerial rootlets.
Huh? Well, they look to me like little white fingers poking out of the brown. I don't like them.
Why not?
I don't know. They look like fingers trying to get at you. I can't help my locks and my dislocks.
Well, I don't know for certain, but I don't think there are any orchids I know that have aerial rootlets quite like that. It may be my fancy, of course.
I don't like them. I can't help thinking of that corpse, that poor Mr. Batten, giving up his life for that thing with funny fingers hanging off it.
But it may not have been that particular plant. That was merely a guess of mine.
Anyhow, I don't like it.
Wedderburn felt a little hurt at her dislike to the plant, but that didn't prevent his talking to her about orchids generally, and this orchid in particular, whenever he felt inclined. At last, the great thing happened. Directly he entered the little glass house some days later, he knew that the spike of the plant had burst out. There was a new odor in the air, a rich, intensely sweet odor that overpowered every other in that crowded, steaming little greenhouse. Directly he noticed this, he hurried down to the strange orchid, and behold, the trailing green spikes bore now three great splashes of blossom from which this overpowering sweetness proceeded. He stopped before them in an ecstasy of admiration. The flowers were white with streaks of golden orange upon the petals, and a wonderful bluish purple mingled there with the gold. He could see at once that the genus was altogether a new one. And the insufferable scent. How hot the place was. The blossoms swam before his eyes. The aerial rootlets he could see were now very long. He made a step toward the thermometer. Suddenly, everything appeared unsteady. The bricks in the floor were dancing up and down. Then the white blossoms, the green leaves behind. Then the whole greenhouse seemed to sweep sideways, and then in a curve upward. At 4:30, his cousin made the tea according to their invariable custom. But Wedderburn didn't come in for his tea.
He's worshipping that horrid orchid, he told himself, and waited 10 minutes. His watch must have stopped. I'll go and call him.
She went straight to the hothouse, and opening the door, called his name. There was no reply. She noticed that the air was very close and loaded with an intense perfume. Then she saw something lying on the bricks between the hot water pipes. For a minute, perhaps, she stood motionless. He was lying face upward at the foot of the strange orchid. The tentacle-like aerial rootlets no longer swayed freely in the air, but were crowded together, a tangle of gray ropes, and stretched tight with their ends closely applied to his chin and neck and hands. She didn't understand. Then she saw from under one of the tentacles upon his cheek, there trickled a little thread of blood. With an inarticulate cry, she ran toward him and tried to pull him away from the leech-like suckers. She snapped two of these tentacles, and their sap dripped red. Then the overpowering scent of the blossom began to make her head reel. How they clung to him! She tore at those tough ropes. She felt she was fainting, knew she must not. She left him and hastily opened the nearest door. And after she'd panted for a moment in the fresh air, she had a brilliant inspiration. She caught up a flower pot and smashed in the windows at the end of the greenhouse. Then she re-entered. She tugged now with renewed strength at Wedderburn's motionless body and brought the strange orchid crashing to the floor. It still clung with the grimmest tenacity to its victims. In a frenzy, she lugged it and him into the open air. Then she thought of tearing through the sucker rootlets one by one. And in another minute, she had released him and was dragging him away from the horror. He was white and bleeding from a dozen circular patches. Wedderburn had lost a good deal of blood, but beyond that he had suffered no great injury. They gave him brandy mixed with some pink extract of meat and carried him upstairs to bed. His housekeeper told her incredible story in fragments to Dr. Haddon, and she said, "Come in the orchid house and see." Well, the cold outer air was blowing in through the open door, and the sickly perfume was almost dispelled. Most of the torn aerial rootlets lay already withered amidst a number of dark stains upon the bricks. The stem of the orchid was broken by the fall of the plant, and the flowers were growing limp and broken at the edges of the petals. The doctor stooped toward it, then, seeing that one of the aerial rootlets still stirred feebly, he hesitated. The next morning, the strange orchid still lay there, black now and putrescent. The door banged intermittently in the morning breeze, and all the array of Wedderburn's orchids had shriveled and were prostrate. But Wedderburn himself was bright and garrulous upstairs in the glory of his strange adventure.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Daniel Sutter. This concludes the present Sleep No More series. We hope it has brought you memorable, wakeful hours. This is Ben Grauer, bidding you good night.
Sleep No More, on Tuned to Yesterday, the final episode in the series from April 24th, 1957 on NBC. And so closes this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.